Call to order the Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. Colleagues, today is February 17th, 2014. We're convened for the purpose of public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 4014, 4038A, and 4051. We are going to start with 4038A since Representative Nathanson is here. And we do plan on moving that today, and the chair is undecided about the others. So that being said, why don't, Chana, anything that we need to tee up?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, 4038A provides a mechanism for tenants of a manufactured dwelling park to compete to purchase the park should the owner decide to sell.
Okay. So I will open a public hearing on House Bill 4038A. Representative Nathanson, would you like to come forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. You all have heard issues undoubtedly about manufactured home parks in the past. Oregon has more than 1,100 manufactured home parks located in 57 of the 60 house districts, so by far most of the state. This kind of housing provides more than 63,000 residential affordable spaces. Residents of these parks are in an awkward position. They often own their home. The basis of this is owned homes, but they're renting the space. These parks are not just locations. They are neighborhoods where people help each other. This housing, where residents rent the space, is not like renting an apartment where you can easily pick up and move. You can't easily pick up and move your home if something were to happen to the park. I'm very pleased to bring you this bill that I worked on together with Representative Gene Wisnett over the last year in 2013. We convened a work group that was comprised of two state representatives, Representative Wisnett and myself, three persons representing tenants or park residents, and seven persons representing landlords or owners. We met three times over the summer and fall, and in between that time, Representative Wisnett and I met either together or separately with various advocates and concerned parties. We also toured together a resident-owned park in Redmond to better understand their circumstances, how they came to own it, what it's like to own it, to be responsible not only for the payments but also improvements to the park and so on. There was an agreement that was reached by the work group on November 19th, agreeing on the form and content of a bill. The bill was available just shortly before the session began, so there were some last-minute changes that were made right before and at the beginning of the session. This bill is very different than an approach that you may have heard something about that was presented in the 2013 session and indeed in previous sessions. This approach is much simplified. The timelines are much shorter and less onerous. The obligations and penalties are much reduced. And the approach is no longer from the point of view of landlord-tenant law. Instead, the committee was advised, particularly by park owners, that this would work much better for them if we would use standard commercial real estate law and look at it from that perspective, because that would be much more familiar to them. The processes are much more straightforward and commonly used. So this bill that you're hearing now, that passed the House unanimously, has been characterized, from what I've heard from both sides, as a truly compromise approach. The tenants, or the residents, have given up a lot. And one very large example of this, the time period in question for this opportunity to purchase in the previous iteration of a proposal was 100 days. That is now reduced to just 25 days. For buyers who are in a hurry because they have a 1031 exchange deadline coming up, those transactions continue to be exempt. In creating this much simplified approach, not every procedural action or possibility is contemplated. Every time the work group started to talk about, well, maybe we should expand the words, maybe we should clarify this or clarify that, we came back to the point of view that let's keep it simple. Everybody had wanted a much simpler approach, and that both sides would show that they were acting in a commercially reasonable manner. There are added protections for owners of parks, for nuisance, for inappropriate delays, and their remedy is simple. If things aren't going the way they think they should, they can just kill the sale. They can just stop working with the residents and move on for sale to someone else. We also have added a protection for misuse of confidential information that is provided during this initial period where you're exchanging information and data, including financial information. So taking a step back, it's just a reminder to us all what the purpose of the bill is. There's already a law in place. This bill provides clarity and improves the process for both residents and park owners. You know, not every park is or should be a residential manufactured home park forever, and not every group of residents should or will want to make an offer to purchase a park. This bill just puts in place a process in those kinds of circumstances where a group of residents is in a position to make an offer. It puts in place a process where they can reasonably do so. I'm very pleased that we were able to develop this compromise approach, and very pleased that my colleague Representative Wisnett and I carried this through over many months of conversation. Thank you.
Representative, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair. Thank you very much. And this is a typical day. I brought my comments. It's talking about free community college. I picked up the wrong thing. I'm sure that the good representative explained the process we went through here. It was very tedious, but I think there was a lot of give and take by everyone. We agreed at the beginning that we all supported the need for this housing, that we have a section of the population that needs this type of low-cost housing. Second, we agreed that we were going to consider the interest of owners, of park owners, and the park tenants, and we worked towards that goal. Not everyone was happy with the final product, but but it's a big, significant number of people supported what we came up with, and I think that the advocates for the tenants did give a lot, as Representative explained to you. 1031 was addressed. We shortened the process. Did you talk about the 100 days? The 20? That was significant. We started talking. That was what the owners did not like about House Bill 3007. It was introduced in the 2013 session. So we worked on that and gave, I think everyone got something out of the bill that you're looking at today. The one group of owners did not, at the end, they talked about they wanted to establish a committee, standing committee, which some states do, to consider purchase. And at the last minute, we said, no, we're not going to consider that. So as far as I know, that's the only thing that we didn't really address. The owners, we did a good job, and the advocates for the tenants at the end compromised on confidentiality, and actually could be legal action taken if you use that data for other reasons than considering purchase. So I enjoyed working with the leadership of Representative Nathanson and all the people that participated, and we did have many meetings and a lot of sharing of information. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions for this panel? Senator George.
As I was reading this bill this weekend, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to figure out, I've been on the committee for quite a few years, and the kind of the big battle over mobile home parks was the Thunderbird in Wilsonville, which is in my district. So I've been very deeply aware of these issues for quite some time now. So in this particular bill, I'm looking at this, and we worked really hard. The last time this legislation went through in 2009 to make sure that the owner was negotiating with one entity, right? It was a really, really important part of that negotiation and that kind of agreement. And in this bill here, it fundamentally strikes at that 2009 agreement that we had, where a landlord would know who they're dealing with. Because as I read this bill, it basically says just one or a couple residents could work to have negotiations. And I can't, from the bill, it seems to leave it vague on how many of these negotiations I would have to have. Like, if it's fractured inside the resident community, I might have to negotiate with 5 or 6 or 7 different groups, theoretically. I mean, I'm not saying it would happen. So I'm trying to figure out, this seems to be a strike at the balance we created in 2009. So was that a discussion in the committee or in the work group?
Mr. Chair and Senator George, I hope that someone else is available in the room to get at some of those specifics, but I can tell you that there is a lot about the law on the books right now that does not favor owners. There's a 14-day right of first refusal, but it's not clear how long you have to keep negotiating. It seems like it might be for an infinite period of time. And what we're trying to do here is clarify it and say there is a window, there's a beginning point, and there's an ending point, and you're not on the hook forever. It also was discussed in the work group whether it's practical to require the formation of a specific kind of committee. And in the work group, there were a few representatives of residents, and there were also quite a few people representing park owners. And in one of the meetings, I believe it might have been a September or November meeting, we did discuss this issue of forming an association or specific committee. And after back and forth conversation, it was agreed it wasn't necessary.
Mr. Chair, may I comment?
Representative, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator George. It's my understanding the intent of the bill before you is that there's one group identified and that they have to reach, you know, they have to select that group, so it's not, and they have a short time frame to identify that group. Was it 15 days or 7 days to identify the intent, or maybe 15? It's the legislative intent. The bill that we pass out of the House is there'll only be one group. They have to act fast to identify themselves. And we did have one group of owners come in at the end and say we'd like to have that standing committee. It was late in the game, and the group decided that, you know, people come and go. So if you have a standing group, are you going to have to renew that every year to say you're still alive or you're still living here or whatever? So that was, we think that this, the other group of owners thought this was much more flexible and better to work.
Mr. Chair,
yep, Senator George.
I think a comment would be, when I read the bill, it seemed like it was really left open. At least that language wasn't tight. And I understand the intent coming over from the House. And I think we had to have a conversation about tightening that language up, because I would hate to see this revolving negotiation with 5 or 6 different groups inside of a tenant park. It just would create a huge problem, I think, and it was a big part of our 2009 negotiations, just so you know. That was one of the big points that we kept saying about, because we didn't want to get into these forever negotiations with a bunch of different miscellaneous right. groups. So,
Can I comment? I think, Senator George, I appreciate those comments. I think you're going to have enough attorneys will argue or could talk to you coming up after the representative.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right. Great. Why don't we bring up John Van Landingham and Peter Hanley, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Van Landingham. I work as a lawyer for Lane County Legal Aid. I represent park residents. I've been in this business of negotiating landlord-tenant amendments for manufactured home parks since 1995. And I facilitate something called the Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition, which has members of both all sides, not just the tenants and residents, but others as well. I want to thank Representatives Wisnett and Nathanson for their leadership. They did a remarkable job trying to find some common ground. I've given you four handouts. I know OLIS was delayed in setup from this morning, but I've brought hard copies as well to be distributed to you. And those four handouts are, first, a detailed summary of the bill. Second, a comparison of current law with the bill. Third, a review of the process that we've gone through in working this issue. It's not just the interim work group that Representative Nathanson and Wisnett led. The coalition has discussed this issue since 2010. We all know what the issues are, and we all know what the positions are. And as the two representatives indicated in their testimony, there's been a lot of give on both sides to get to this point right now. The fourth handout is one that addresses an issue that was raised that might be a little bit relevant to the question that Senator George asked, and it's a question that Senator Bartsugar asked me when we met with him last week. And I guess I should note that I think we've both sides have talked to all members of the committee, and so I'm not going to bore you by reviewing the bill all over again. But anyway, the question that Senator Bartsugar asked, and so did some other senators, was, what if multiple tenants want to respond? Do they each get 10 days? And the answer is no. There's one 10-day period. It runs from the date of the delivery of the landlord's notice that he or she is interested in selling the park, and that's it. The notice probably, it's not required in the statute, we don't say this, but the notice from the landlord probably would have an end date that says, tenants, you got 10 days by X date to tell me that you're interested in competing to buy my park. And if that date arrives and they have not done that, that's all the landlord has to do. So there's one 10-day period. It's not like tenant A gets 10 days and then tenant B gets another 10 days, tenant C gets another 10 days. There are a number of places in the Landlord-Tenant Act already where we have similar provisions where there is one period. People have to act within, for example, rule changes. People have to act within that period. When the period runs, that's it. Let me talk globally for a minute. This is a fairly simple issue, and I actually struggle to understand why some landlords are so resistant to it. What we're talking about here is requiring landlords to tell their tenants, people who own their own manufactured homes, they've invested in that park by buying a manufactured home. And I should note, some of those homes cost more than six figures. $100,000 manufactured homes in parks. Their investment is tied up in what happens to that park. So these people, they don't own the land, clearly. And the landlord, we're not taking away anybody's property rights to sell the park, close the park, whatever. The landlord is entitled to do those things. Oregon is not going to change the law about park closures to prevent closures. It's not possible. It's not going to happen. So if the landlord wants to sell the park or close the park, the landlord can. But should the landlord tell the tenants and give them a very short period, Representative Nathanson said 25 days. It actually could be shorter than that. If the tenants respond, it's a 10-day period and then a 15-day period. The 15-day period starts after the tenants get financial information from the landlord. If you're selling your park, you should already have that financial information. It's called a broker's package. It's not onerous. It's the kind of information that any buyer is going to want to know. So if you get a notice, a response from the tenants within day one, that says we're interested in buying and we want the financial information, the landlord hands them the financial information on day one, it's a 15-day period, not a 25-day period. 15 days for the tenants to make an offer. So should the landlord let tenants know about the sale and give them a chance to compete to buy the park? There's no right of first refusal. In fact, current law provides that. This bill would take it away. Keep in mind, we're not writing on a blank slate. In 1989, the legislature adopted a number of statutes, 90.760, 90.800. I've given you a memo comparing them. There are problems from both sides with those statutes that we all agree. And I've outlined for you how the bill would fix those problems. One of the concepts that we followed in the work group that was suggested by one of the main landlord group's lawyer was, rather than start all over and create some complicated procedure, which is a typical Van Landingham approach to mobile home park law, let's just take the current statutes and do commercial real estate practice and make it simple. And that's what the bill tries to do. I want to mention that it's important to recognize who lives in these parks. I think Representative Nathanson indicated the number of parks, the number of spaces, about 63,000 spaces around the state of Oregon. Typically, they're occupied by seniors, people with disabilities, people on fixed income, low-income starter families, farm workers. And they're in homes that might range from $5,000 to $100,000. It's viewed as the largest privately provided source of affordable housing in the United States. I mentioned earlier we know what the issues are. The issues are notice to tenants, all tenants, or just as the opponents propose, which is we would have to have some pre-established group. That's the current law. It doesn't work. Tenants don't get notice because they don't create pre-established groups, and I can talk about that more if that's a question for you, about why that hasn't worked. So the time periods, notice, third-party buyers, the bill, for example, makes it clear, unlike current law, that during this short period of time, the landlord has the right to go out and solicit other buyers and negotiate with those buyers. It's not like a timeout. The landlord can start the process. Tenants have a certain period of time to make an offer, and if they don't, that's all for the tenants. But the landlord can go out and seek other buyers and negotiate with them and have a deal ready to go if the tenants can't pull it off. There's information about requirement for financial information, about confidentiality. We're clarifying that 1031 exchange buyers, so a buyer coming into a transaction who is bidding to buy the park, those people have certain timelines by which they must buy a replacement property or they don't get their capital gains exemption on federal tax law. So those people are exempted. If that's who your buyer is, landlord, you're done. You don't have to do any of this process. I want to also recognize that not all parks are suitable for this. In some senses, I've had people say to me that we're making a mountain out of a molehill, because it's not going to happen that often that the residents compete to buy the park. We've been working on this for 5 years, as I said, and so far we've been able to purchase, the residents have been able to purchase 7 parks. And that's great, but that's not a ton. When there are 1,100 parks, 7 is not a significant number. We would like to see there be more. We hope there will be more. Park purchase or ownership by the residents addresses the 4 biggest concerns of residents, which is the risk of closure, the risk of rent increases, poor management, poor infrastructure, maintenance. They own the park. Peter Hanley will talk a little bit about some of the parks that have been purchased by the residents and how those factors have been addressed with resident ownership. But it's not suitable for all parks. The park that Senator George mentioned, the owner there wanted $50 million. The residents could not possibly have competed to buy that park. And the $50 million value, which in hindsight probably was extreme, was based on his view of that land redeveloped as some other use. In other words, high-end residential, because it was inside the UGB and could be developed. So a lot of parks are not suited for resident ownership. A lot of parks the residents aren't going to want to try to compete. But what we're talking about here is giving the residents a chance to compete. The bill is very clear that the owner does not have to accept their offer. The owner can make counteroffers, can reject their offer. All it's saying is that the residents find out about the sale and have a chance to make an offer. What could be bad about competition? If you're the seller of a product, wouldn't you want competition? I'll stop there. I don't know if Senator George wants me to respond to his question earlier. I could do that some more.
You okay?
Mr. Chair, yeah, I mean, John, what I'm trying to focus on is that, I mean, the way I read the language in the bill, it isn't really specific, and I think you acknowledge that. It's not really specific on this 10-day, that it's one 10-day period, and that there's and the question is, can we tighten that up a little bit? I mean, it really seems like that could lead to litigation. You know, there's just some things in there that are just, that aren't very tight as far as, and I know these are special sessions, and I mean, they're short sessions, and so these things are rushed a little bit, but I mean, I really worry about, as you know, how litigious this particular area of law is, and it means a lot to people who are trying to move a piece of real estate. Can we tighten that language up in the 10 days?
Chair Shields, Senator George, couple of comments. I do think it's clear that it's one 10-day period, and I've put on the record my view of that, and I think that since I'm the person that's done most of the drafting and spent untold hours negotiating with legislative counsel to try to get the November 19th proposal, which was 2.5 pages of detail, into the form that you see it now, and I've probably gone through 5 drafts with legislative counsel to get to this point. I do think it's clear that it's one 10-day period. You're actually asking a related question, which is, could more than one tenant make an offer to purchase? And I think the answer to that is yes, because the language here refers to all tenants. It continually says all tenants or the tenants may do these things. That's typically how we've done things in the Act. So this is not the first time. I mean, the Act was adopted in 1975. So the issue has been there for a while. And I would note that the current law on a landlord's duty to notify the tenants and negotiate with them allows more than one tenant group to compete to buy. So the current law requires tenant associations in advance, which the bill does not, and I could talk more about why we think that's a hugely important issue. But it allows more than one association under the current law. So it's not a new issue. Even if this bill dies, that issue is still there. Our practical experience has been that there are not multiple tenants competing to buy. They're not going to each be able to get a lender who's interested in working with them. They're not going to be able to get the technical assistance from CASA to figure out whether it makes sense to make an offer. So that's part of the answer. The other part is you've been doing this a long time, too. And I'm sorry that you're leaving, frankly. But the coalition has made a commitment over its life since 1997 of fixing things that need to be fixed. And if this proves truly to be a problem, we'll come back in 2015 and fix it. I'm not retiring yet. And so that's a commitment I have always made and will always make. Amending the bill at this point now risks losing the bill because of the shortness of the session. So practically speaking, I would prefer not to amend the bill. And practically speaking, it hasn't been a problem to date.
And yes, Senator George.
Just to follow up on a different issue, because there's some technical issues that have been brought up, both when I read it and then when the opponents have brought issues up. And there's one issue I'd like you to address is has to do with this. Currently, because most of these things are owned in LLCs, and transfers between the owners of an LLC, the opponents have brought up this issue, and I'm sure they're going to discuss it. But can you give your perspective? Because the way it reads seems to say that if a father the father and two sons own the LLC, and they transfer it among each other, that would trigger this process. Do you read that? Because it seems like it does read that way in the bill.
Chair Shields, Senator George, what we're referring to is Section 4 of the bill, which lists a number of transactions which are exempted from the requirement. Mm-hmm. And that language is largely taken from the existing statute, 90.820 sub 4, so which, as I said earlier, was adopted in 1989, which was the last time we had a park closure crisis, and the legislature tried to solve it. That language does not exempt LLCs because LLCs weren't, I guess, in practice in 1989. I agree that LLCs ought to be included in this list.
Okay.
The opponents did not raise that until, in fact, they've never directly raised it with me. We've done amendments that the opponents asked for on November 19th at the last interim work group, and again on February 3rd when Representative Wisnett and Nathanson called one last fourth meeting of the work group and asked for some more changes. They did not ask for that change then about LLCs. If they had, I would have agreed to it. It's a fair point, and we ought to exempt transfers within an LLC. And I will say again, I'd make the commitment that I'll be back in 2015 to fix that. But let me remind you, the current law does not exempt transfers within an LLC, and their own bill, which I don't believe has been introduced, their version of our bill, which was the Dash 2, also does not exempt LLCs. So it's apparently an issue that has arisen of late. I'll try and fix it in 2015.
Senator George.
John, not to sandbag you on something, but over the weekend I got amendments back. If you look at the Dash 5s,
I just
gave them to committee staff when I walked in here. That's why I was late, actually, to make sure I got them. I just have an amendment that addresses that specific issue. So you might take a look at it and see if it's something if you can agree to it quickly, that'd be great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. And so, John, your position is that the bill, as currently written, even if there were two or three parties that wanted to put a bid in, that the 10 days would still apply to all.
Chair Shields, absolutely. It's one 10-day period for all the tenants. I don't think there, it's hard for me to see how it could be read otherwise. Okay. It is true that there could be multiple tenants that within that 10-day period say, we want to compete to buy. That's not our experience. That's not our intent. It hasn't happened in the past. It's the current law allows the same sort of dynamic. But it is one 10-day period, and it runs from the date the landlord delivers the notice. In an earlier question that was raised by the opponents on the House side, the question was, well, what if we don't have everybody's addresses? And so wouldn't that just delay the 10-day period? No. The answer is no, and I put that on the record on the House side. The correct answer to that, as a lawyer, legally, is that landlords are not required to prove that tenants got the notice. They're required only to prove that they gave the notice. Whether the tenant gets the notice or not is irrelevant legally. So the landlord's duty is to give the notice. And once the landlord gives the notice, the period runs from the time the landlord delivers the notice. That's it.
Thank you. Peter.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Peter Hainley. I'm Executive Director of Community and Shelter Assistance Corporation, also known as CASA of Oregon and Sherwood, Oregon. CASA has been working over the last 7 years to develop a program to help residents purchase their parks. We've converted seven parks to resident ownership, representing 431 spaces. This bill will allow us to move quicker. Currently, we negotiate with owners on the purchase of the park and then, through an assignable purchase and sale, then negotiate with the tenants. It isn't an ideal situation. It creates some distrust because the tenants are wondering why we're negotiating on their behalf. We're working under a confidentiality agreement with the seller, which doesn't allow us to disclose to the tenants until we've actually negotiated an agreement. So what this will do is this will allow a much more deliberate process with the residents to allow them to put in an offer. To that question of multiple tenants making the offers, our intent is, after this law is passed, is that we would then have the opportunity to get notice to go in and help those residents put that purchase offer together, and so that that would happen within that 10-day period, and that there would not be competing tenants. And with that, I'll just take any questions that you may have.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thanks.
Let's bring up Amber Monti, Brian Johnson, Richard Costa-San. Welcome to the committee.
You want me to start? Go ahead. Mr. Chair, Richard Costa-San with the Oregon Park Owners Alliance. And we participated in the work group throughout the year, and I would echo the comments made by Mr. Van Landingham in terms of our appreciation for an effort coordinated predominantly by Representative Nathanson and Representative Gene Wisnett. We were a little bit disillusioned at the end of the process, however. I think a few people around the table felt that at the 12th hour we were given a set of amendments that were ironed out between two individual parties sitting around that table with the exclusion of others. So we do have some concerns. We started out the work group process and our position was trying to hit a very defined balance between the interests of the park owners and the interests of the tenants. And as constructed, we believe that the balance is not met. The tenants and third parties, as just was echoed, are now, I think, in a superior position to that of the park owners. One should refer to House Bill 2383 in 2009, setting up a process and very explicitly providing tenants a right of first refusal to purchase a park if they are so interested. And that is another piece of that work group. We asked many times for examples, subsequent to the existing law in 2009, where one tenant or multiple tenants have tried to buy or attempted to buy a property and were not afforded that opportunity. And we have yet to be provided any examples. In terms of the two issues that have previously been discussed, I would refer the committee to provisions in Section 1, coupled with those provisions in Subsection 5 of Section 2 of the bill. Today, under current law, a tenant or a tenant's group has a responsibility to form and identify a tenant's association. This does away with that. We now have a period of 10 days, but the provisions contained in Section 2 suggest that there is an additional 15-day period. And after that first 10-day period, coupled with an additional 15 days, the tenants then must form an entity. So during that first 10-day period, could a owner be faced with the situation of addressing one, two, or three, or multiple tenants or tenants association? And I think the answer, as the bill is currently constructed, is definitely yes. And keep in mind that tenants association, or that entity with which the owner is responsible to deal with, is not formed prior to that time. It's established after that initial 10-day period and after an additional 15-day period. That would be my reading and how the bill is constructed right now. But with that, Mr. Chair, we do remain concerned with the bill and concerned with the bill in terms of the application in the real world in the future, and I think it's very problematic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Johnson, Chair and Committee. I had given you a letter that I wrote, but I my thing here is I'm have four generations have worked at our facility, which is Johnson Mobile Estates in the city of Johnson City. So we provide low-income, affordable housing to 279 residents. Some of these things, when I'm hearing before me, is they're kind of confusing some of it with park closure, like they have to move their house or this. That's like park closure. That's like a Wilsonville deal, which is a whole nother deal. So even if you sold the park, they're not having to pack up their $100,000 house, or you know. But it would, the way we read it too, is you could have multiple people just come in there and want to do it that aren't necessarily business people, just want to throw a wrench into the deal. And then if it doesn't go through, then my tenants have my financial records. And there's a big difference between tenants having your financial record than someone at Caldwell Banker that's a broker. They will just go through it and they will just make mountains out of molehills. We are against this bill the way it is written now, and we would hope that we wouldn't pass it.
Thank you, Mr.
Because no, he has said too before that they've sold seven of them. It's working now. Why change it? Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Chairman Shields, members of the committee, thank you very much for giving me an opportunity to speak with you today. I'm an Oregon park owner. I own two mobile home parks in the state of Oregon.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
Oh, I'm Amber Monty. And I also manage some properties in Grants Pass, Kaiser, Medford, White City, Fairview, and Eugene and Salem, to name a few. I believe, as I'm sure you do as well, that mobile home parks are some of the very best form of non-subsidized affordable housing in the state of Oregon. I think it's very important then, when we look at making changes to the laws, that we take into account the many seniors and the families that rely on this type of housing.
I also know you're under a lot of pressure to pass this bill. I was a member of the work group. I've also been a member of the coalition. So I can tell you firsthand that there was not a consensus on this bill. In fact, I'm very embarrassed about the bill that was given to you for passage. I think, as you heard from previous testimony, one of the attorneys who wrote it admitted that there are problems with it, but rather than fixing those problems, he's urging you to just quickly push it through without addressing the issues. Sitting next to me is a gentleman who owns a property, and if he owns that property as an LLC and this bill goes through in its current state, if something were to happen to him, this could cause all sorts of problems for his family. This is a man who's developed a property, and he's invested countless hours and time into doing so. And to push a bill forward that knowingly has these problems, I think would be extreme disservice to not only the tenants, but also to the industry. This bill there's many issues with it. I've tried to narrow it down because I know you don't have all day to listen to me give testimony. But the LLC issue is a very, very important one that really needs your attention. In addition to that, the issue about multiple tenant groups being able to form during that initial 10-day period and make offers simultaneously could cause extreme problems within the property and will most definitely lead to lawsuits and litigation. Now, the bill was written by two attorneys, so maybe that's the point. Maybe they'll stand to benefit from all of the problems that the bill in its current state will cause. But, you know, oftentimes they'll try and depict park owners as people, as bad people. But in reality, a lot of the park owners are like this gentleman sitting to my left and myself, who just in the city of Salem alone, I'm currently developing 54 additional sites for families. And I'm probably going to fill those sites with homes that I'm going to sell for below cost to families. We're doing good work in the state, and I think that it's important for you to look at the possible negative effects that the bill in its current state will cause to the affordable housing industry, because the causes will be severe. The causes could be, as I mentioned, litigation, even park closures. I mean, these are not the purpose of the bill is to help the affordable housing industry, to help, you know, families and seniors, not to cause more problems. In the work group, there wasn't, or in any of the hearings that have taken place on the current bill or on the previous bills that John Van Lanningham attempted to push through, there wasn't any tenants who came up to testify to say, "Hi, I really wanted to purchase my mobile home park, and so did all my neighbors, but we were unable to under the current law." There wasn't a single testimony to that effect. In fact, the members of CASA, he just testified that, in fact, they've been able to have 7 park purchases under the current law. The current law is working, and I feel that to hastily push through this bill would be a big mistake, and I would really like to ask for your assistance in making some of these amendments to fix the bill rather than push it through.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Prasansky.
So I'm hearing your testimony. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name, but you're part of the work group. Are any of your businesses LLCs?
All of them.
And so, I mean, all of a sudden this just comes out of the blue. I mean, this is existing law right now does not have an exemption for LLCs. And all of a sudden it seems like this has come up as something new. I mean, it seems like your attorneys or someone else's should have been bringing you to the speed that this was a problem. Now you want us to stop a bill because this problem's come forward.
Right, and I understand your concern. What happened was we had many work group meetings, but this bill wasn't actually proposed until the very last one. It wasn't given to me even the day before the meeting. So it wasn't until the final work group meeting that this bill was even proposed. So I had literally no opportunity to make any suggestions or explain the problems. I didn't even have time to read it. And so as they read it in the final work group, I made a list of problems, and when I brought those problems up, they were unwilling to listen to them.
Okay. Follow up. So, but the existing law does not provide for an exemption for LLCs. Is that correct?
Right, and our goal was to work to address the existing law and make improvements.
Right, but you didn't bring it up during the work group before meetings, and then what I understand, there's a meeting on February 3rd after or right when we came in the session, after you had a chance to look at the bill, and now all of a sudden, from what I'm hearing from my perspective, here's another reason why we shouldn't move something forward. Oh, yeah, but we didn't address it earlier, even though its existing law does not provide for that exemption.
My understanding was the LLC issue was brought up. I didn't personally bring it up, but my understanding is that we did previously bring this up.
I think we understand the point of view, but Richard, go ahead, and I do want to make sure you guys feel heard. I think my intention is we can address that in 2015, but fire away, we do want to hear your...
Chair Shields, and to follow up on Senator Brzozinski's question, it was kind of a last minute, yes, indeed, and we're not suggesting to end the bill because of that. With, I think, a very good effort to clarify a couple of points within the bill, that would be preferred.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Look, can I ask one other question, please?
Sure.
Richard, I guess this is for you. I have not seen Senator George's A5s. I'm kind of glancing at them. But I guess the question is, if we made that amendment and put that into the bill, are you saying that your organization will stand down and support the bill with the dash A5s for passage concurrence on the House side to become law now?
Senator Shields and Senator Brzozinski, I think you would pick up a good deal of support. I don't know if you would pick up unanimous support.
My question is to you as a lobbyist for your organization, because I understand there's two parts here that seem to be at friction.
Mm-hmm.
If we stop this right now and put the A5s in, I want to know whether or not you're going to allow that bill to go back over there with concurrence and have a unified front with Mr. Van Lanningham and his organization, Mr. Carpenter's, or not.
Chair Shields and Senator Brzozinski, that amendment, and perhaps I would like to see in Section 1 just a clarification of who an owner is actually responsible to deal with, and with those, from my position, that would be a drastic improvement, and would I support concurrence with the House? Yes.
All right, so if we just had the one part.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
I've got dash fours to deal with that other issue also, which deals with both of those, with both of those two fronts. So they're fairly simple, straightforward amendments that are not very onerous.
Mr. Chair, how long are we going today?
Well, we've got to be on the floor at 11?
11.
Yeah.
Could we turn the lights off again?
This is what the chair's prerogative is going to do, so everybody knows where we're going to go. I don't feel comfortable introducing the amendments at this particular point. You do have my commitment to bring them back and address those bills in 2015. So that's where I am. So I don't think we're going to have a whole lot of debate about this today. We'll just have to vote the way our conscience tells us. So thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Chuck Carpenter.
Good morning, committee members. My name is Chuck Carpenter. I'm Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, and I've been dealing with this issue through the coalition for the last 5 years. And we were very active last legislative session, and with some of you, to defeat House Bill 3007, which we were able to do in the House. The result of that defeat was the involvement by Representative Wisnant and Representative Nathanson to come up with a solution this legislative session. And we had our attorney, Phil Quarin, who's a very well-known real estate attorney in Oregon, negotiate along with the members of the work group, and specifically with John Van Landingham, to come up with a fair compromise. My board gave this direction to myself and to Phil and June, and we talked about it some more in an August board session, and as well in October, and the board unanimously supported the concept of what we came up with in December. And they've continued to express that support, and the feeling of the MHCO board at this time is to move forward on this bill. There were some things that we felt we got out of these negotiations. One was that we had very, very specific timelines, very, very specific that you can decline, that after the 10 days or the 15 days, the landlord, he or she can say, no, I want to go with this other deal. And we also, thanks to the contribution of Representative Wisnett, we instead of creating this whole new body of law, which House Bill 3007 created, we took basic real estate law and allowed that there would be a 10-day process and a 15-day process. During that process, the landlord, he or she, can continue to work with a broker, work with putting advertising out, marketing the property, negotiating, whatever they want to do. That was a huge difference from what we were faced with in House Bill 3007, which basically said, 100 days, you're frozen. You can't do anything. You can't even talk to a broker or to Commonwealth Real Estate Services to move, to do anything. And that truly gave the residents a right of first refusal. The other thing that this, and so we're happy that we've gone from this 100-day proposal that we've been talking about in House Bill 3007 and we've been talking about for the last 5 years down to 10 and 15 very specific days. The other thing that we are pleased about with this legislation is that we eliminate the 14-day right of first refusal that currently exists in statute and the confusion of the notification process. So we probably could sit here for another 5 years and talk about the merits of this bill. But the long and short of it is we spent a lot of time and effort making sure that our association attorney, who is an expert in real estate law, was thoroughly involved in this process, from developing the initial concepts to advising the board to working. He was a member of the work group, to coming up with the legislation, working with legislative counsel, and going through this so that it was a well-vetted bill. So we are happy to work with the chair. We're happy to work with John Van Landingham and the Landlord-Tenant Coalition to work on the LLC issue or any other problems that come up with this as a result of this. But overall, although in a perfect world, we wouldn't want to have this kind of statute on the books, that's not the world where we deal with. And we feel that the work group came up with a fair compromise.
Okay. Any questions for Chuck? Senator Martin Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously, we have some manufactured owners that agree with this and obviously don't agree. You represent manufactured owners who are mobile home park owners that do agree with this. And I want to get a sense of what percentage of mobile home park owners you represent versus the opposition.
Chair, Senator Monas Anderson, we represent 460 manufactured home communities. We brought on, actually 462, brought on two new parks this last week, and we have 25 associate members. Now, I want to be specific. My board has said unanimously supported this bill. As with any organization with that many members, not everybody agrees, but I think that the board understands why we are doing this, what the goal was when we set out after the last legislative session, what the goal was, and I think the board feels that we achieved that what we wanted to achieve.
Okay. Senator George.
Hey, Chuck, you know, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've worked closely with you guys on this thing.
Yep.
One of the things I've appreciated is that with the work you've done with John and others and CASA is to bring forward things to us on this area that is in a tight package that everybody agrees on. And the reason why this particular legislation makes me very, very nervous is that when I read it, the language seems to be very loosey-goosey, and then there's these issues that are brought up by the opponents, which just sort of add to that whole thing. And it seems like to me we're sitting here in February, session is in January, it'd be very easy to try to get everybody on board and take care of these issues. And I'm not sure what the, there's no emergency going on right now. There's no park out there that's in. So why can't we just kick this to January and then make sure you guys get all back on board? Because I think fracturing this coalition has really bad ramifications for the future. And I think you guys can come to a solution by January. And I don't see the emergency. And I think fracturing the coalition is much more dangerous than a delay of 9 months.
Chair, Senator George, thank you for all your help in helping to defeat 3007 last year. You were very helpful in us being able to achieve that. I think, Senator, the reality is that although these issues have been brought up today, those who have been opposed to this legislation have been opposed to it for a very long time. And I think a lot of people have tried to reach out to understand what their position was, to ask what their position was, what would make that a good piece of legislation. As early as June, I think basically a copy of what, in broad brushstrokes, what we were going to try to achieve from the standpoint of the MHCO board, what they wanted to achieve was conveyed to the opponents, and that was just flatly rejected. And I think we got into a situation in the work group where there were people who were willing to work on a compromise, and there were people who weren't willing to work on a compromise. And those of us who believe with Representative Wisnett and Representative Nathanson and other landlords, there were three or four MHCO board members in the work group. In the end, we felt we worked out an agreement that had as broad a support as we could have at that time. And we would like to go forward with this and try to, if there are things that need to be changed, change it in the landlord-tenant bill legislation when we meet again and try to correct it that way. But the folks who oppose this have always opposed it. And, you know, I think we've come, when we had the negotiations a week ago last Monday with Representative Wisnett and Representative Nathanson, I think that I certainly left the Capitol that evening thinking that we had generally reached an agreement. And then the next day, that simply was not the case. So at this point, we feel we'd like to move forward, and I don't think it's going to affect the landlord-tenant coalition at all, Senator. I mean, particularly if the people who voice said no are going to continue to say no, well, what's the point? I mean, it reaches a point where what can you do to bring people on board? And quite frankly, we're exasperated.
Mr. Chair,
let's make a comment.
The issue is that I think there was a feeling that there was a drawing closer together in last week, and that there was some way to get to yes. And what I'm concerned about is I don't see the emergency for this legislation, and the concerns are significant, and I think they're, and it seems like you guys can work this out. And I think what's going to happen is it does fracture this, at least from my perspective. Mm-hmm. It does, and it seems like you guys are so close that what's 9 months in this law? It doesn't seem, there's no emergency causing us to take action, and yet if we do something wrong, it could be significant and it could fracture it. And that's mm-hmm. kind of my big concern.
Thank you. We've talked this through.
Okay.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Chair.
So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4038A and open a work session on House Bill 4038A. Senator Martin Sanderson.
Chair, I move House Bill 4038A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Mona Sanderson has moved House Bill 4038A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator George.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move. I've put two amendments on the floor, and I don't know if we've actually had them on time long enough.
10:45.
So we've got 15 minutes right now before these are legal amendments. But the Dash 4s deal with the issue that I was concerned about, that I saw that were important to me, which has to do with the fact that I'm concerned about having multiple parties to negotiate with. And the Dash 5s is the issue that was brought up a few minutes ago with the Limit Liability Corporation. And I think this would get us much closer to a bipartisan vote. And then they seem like small, insignificant issues, but I think it gets us closer to more the way this particular law has been dealt with for the last 7 years. So I'd like to move the Dash 4 amendments as soon as we hit 10:45.
Well, I can appreciate that. We do have a motion on in before us so that we're going to need to act on.
You got one other person.
So let's discuss this current motion first. Senator Baird Sugar.
Thank you, Chair Shields. Chair Shields, you know, I think we've all seen us move legislation, and then after it's implemented, we've seen that we've made some mistakes and we have to bring it back and do this and do that. Well, here, we haven't moved this legislation. We've already identified that there's problems in it. And there's no emergency here. I don't know why we would knowingly and willingly move some legislation through this process. It doesn't make any sense to me. So I'll leave it at that.
Anyone else?
Mr. Chair, the reason I want to go forward with House Bill 4038 is this is a product, and the changes that they did make in this, there's nothing wrong with that. We just can make some more additional changes in 2015. And because there is, it is a work group, bipartisan, as well as between manufactured park owners and residents, I feel at least with this bill, it can go forward, and then we will definitely come back and address the concerns, additions that need to be made to the law in 2015.
And I think my point is I'd be willing to afford you that courtesy if I felt like there was a chance that the amendments could get adopted. I think my personal point of view now is that if we did wait till 10:45, the amendments would be rejected by the committee. That's the sense, and I'd like to hear from Senator Przanski shortly. So I do think there are nuggets that can be addressed, I would like to address them in the future sessions. Particularly, I think the people who came forth and testified, I do want you to know that your testimony was heard, and these issues will be addressed. And I commit to you that we will submit a bill in 2015 from this committee to address the LLC issue. And I'd like to get the partners to convene to work on that between now and January. Senator Przanski, did you have anything?
I mean, the questions I asked of the panel that's opposing the bill that has been brought forward, I mean, if they had said that they would go forward with the A5s, which was the LCC, we heard from the other proponents for the bill saying this is something they'd be willing to work on. In the reality, that issue has been there since, well, it's there right now as an issue that it should have been and could be adopted in the future. So I don't know if there's a rush, but if they would have done that and said they'd stand down, that'd be fine. This part about the A4, about having tenants who form more than one group and then have them somehow come together. I mean, you may have just like multiple offers from private parties. You may have one group of tenants who prefer to do it one way versus another. And I don't see why you would need to force all of the tenant groups to come into one group to come forward under the time frame that they have. So, you know, as it is now, I would love to have had the LLC issue addressed with the understanding that the opponents were going to be willing to support the bill. I believe that the work group did the work they did. You had some issues that were not addressed on either side that either side wanted. And so this is a consensus product that does have some work that still need to be looked at in the future, but I don't see a reason why it shouldn't move forward as is right now.
And I do appreciate it. I got a phone message from Senator George this morning. I assume it was to give me a heads up that this would be introduced. I hadn't listened to it, but I do appreciate that, you know, this wasn't a last-minute thing from your perspective. You did try to get us some point of view. I just feel like if, you know, if it was going to change the outcome, we give it a pause.
Yes, sure. I got the amendments back on at 5:15 on Friday, so I apologize to the committee. As you know, these timelines are very, very quick right now.
Yeah.
So there's no, and obviously there's other amendments that I think should be considered, but these are two that I thought could bring us to some kind of consensus that would be not too controversial. But
yeah.
Thank you.
Well, and this was a very good discussion. I think that the points that you all brought up are points that you rightfully brought to the committee, and you have my commitment that we will address these in 2015. And I think your testimony played a vital role in making sure that you got that commitment from us. So thank you for being here. So we are in work session. Any further discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Senator Berkshire?
No.
Senator Montes Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Pozanski?
Aye.
Senator Vice Chair George?
No.
Chair Shields?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries.
Mr.
And Senator Montes Anderson will be the carrier.
Mr. Chair, I serve notice of potential minority report.
Expect nothing less. We'll close the work session on House Bill 4038A, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 4014. Chenna.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, House Bill 4014 comes to you from Representative Krieger. It passed through the House Committee on Business and Labor with an 11-0 vote and across the floor with a unanimous vote. This measure deals with portable electronics insurance, and it, under current statute, an insurer can immediately cancel insurance purchased for portable electronics if the customer ceases to have active wireless service with the carrier, or if the customer exhausts the aggregate limit liability limits under the term of the policy, and if the notice of the termination is sent within 30 days after the criteria are met. House Bill 4014 removes the notice requirement for immediate cancellation when the customer ceases to have active wireless service with the vendor policyholder, and in situations in which a customer exhausts the limited liability of policy, coverage will continue until notice of termination is sent.
All right. Sean Miller. Welcome to the committee.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I'm here today representing Assurion, which is the leading basic company that provides cell phone insurance. The cell phone insurance provisions are basically offered through companies like AT&T, Verizon, all your major wireless carriers. And we're here today in support of 4014. And essentially, the bill did pass unanimously through the House, but it does two simple things. It basically removes an unnecessary notice provision in the statute, and then also adds a consumer protection provider provision regarding the aggregate limits, and I'll explain what aggregate limits are. But why we introduced the bill is just to line up the notice provisions of this particular statute with the other states that have portable electronics insurance. And it was just a few sessions ago that this was actually an unregulated product. Legislature did put it in the insurance statute as an insurance product since it was an emerging insurance product. Most states, if not all, now have put this statute in the insurance code. But the notice provision that we are eliminating, if you look on page 2 of the bill, dealing with active service, and to understand the insurance follows the service of the phone, a little different than the actual phone itself. And so, for instance, if you have cell phone insurance through AT&T and you choose to move to another carrier or stop service, that stops your insurance coverage. It's a line item that's on your bill itself, so it actually follows the service. And so this particular notice requirement says that you have to notify the customer within 30 days after you cease active service. That's a consumer-driven decision. You can decide to stop service with AT&T or Verizon or other service. And what this says that if the consumer cancels service or you stop service, the insurer then has to provide notice after the fact that you're terminated from coverage. Well, that it's unnecessary because the consumer is the one who just terminated the coverage. So it's kind of a redundant or unnecessary notice requirement that in most states they haven't adopted. And so we're asking to have that removed, again, because it's a consumer-driven decision whether you're going to continue service or not. So sending a notice after the fact doesn't make a lot of sense. The second provision that we're doing is dealing with the exhaustion of these limits. And under cell phone insurance, most carriers, I guess Verizon, AT&T, you're allowed 2 claims in a 12-month period. And so if you damage the phone, break the phone, lose the phone, drop it in the water like I have, you get it replaced. Essentially, a claim is a replacement of the phone. They replace the phone that you have. That 2 or 3 times in a 12-month period is exhausting the aggregate limits under the policy. If you exhaust the limits, the current law says you have 30 days now to cancel or terminate coverage like you do under the insurance policy. And what we're adding here is if the insurer does not send the timely notice of termination within that 30 days, that the consumer still has coverage. So if you do not receive the notice, notwithstanding that you've exhausted your limits, and let's say you've had two claims and you haven't had the notice sent to you, and you have a third claim, you break the phone, you actually continue and still have service even though you've exhausted your aggregate limits. The way the law read before, it was unclear because you were required to send the notice within 30 days, but you could have exhausted your limits. So the question is, do you have service or not? And if not, or if you do have service, is it worth anything since you've exhausted the limits? This makes it real clear. And so, again, that provision is, we believe, a consumer protection provision on sending the notice and making sure that you have that that period of time where you're still covered until you're terminated. And then, again, the first one just deals with what we feel is an unnecessary notification. And that's what the bill does. We urge the support of House Bill 4014. I'm happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Sean. Did on the House side, did the Insurance Division testify on this bill?
Mr. Chair, they did not testify. They're neutral on the bill, and I worked with them on the language to make sure that the language, as you know, when the Insurance Division stays neutral on all bills. But I, from a technical assistance side, we pre-session filed this bill, ran this by the Insurance Division. They said it's fine, and then I've also had further conversations with them regarding the interpretation of this exhaustion of the limits language. So there's an understanding there between us and them. That I think is for the consumer's benefit. And so even though they're neutral, I worked quite a bit with them.
Okay. Is Teresa around? I saw her out in the hall before. Teresa Van Winkle, are you listening? And did you have any discussion? I mean, I understand. My perception is that this is cell phones are an issue that is brought to the Department of Justice Consumer Protection line pretty regularly. Is has DOJ had any conversations with you about this topic?
No, Mr. Chair, and I haven't had any issues with the DOJ regarding cell phone insurance in particular. Okay. I mean, it's like I said, it's a pretty simple insurance line. It's voluntary, low cost, and again, the claim is just the replacement of the phone. And I've not heard of any issues at the Department of Justice.
Are there any instances? I mean, are there exceptions to the policy where if you do certain things, you would not get a new cell phone?
Sure, I'd have to look into that. Again, that's in the policy provisions of the documents, and it probably depends on the carrier. But I can get you that information. You know, it's really loss, and replacement of the phone, damage. I think I have a list here in my testimony, but I'm happy to provide that to you. But it's. Again, it's mostly damage, water damage, phone breaking, anything that you would do, dropping it on the floor here in the Capitol.
Could you just send an email to the professional staff? It doesn't necessarily relate to this bill, but it might set my mind at ease about the general concept of moving forward with this. If there were, some assurances that that if the owner of the phone actually does cause harm to the phone, that wouldn't be a reason for denial of the claim. Ms. Van Winkle, would you mind coming forward and just expressing the Insurance Division's position?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Teresa Van Winkle, Senior Policy Advisor at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I apologize. I was in the middle of a phone call. So can you repeat the question?
Yeah. Are you okay with this, and why?
Mr. Chair, I believe we are neutral on the bill. I don't recall any concerns. I do know if I recall them, then look at Mr. Miller. I believe this was in front of the Insurance Advisory Committee and has been vetted in that capacity. Is that correct?
Yeah. I believe so.
Okay. Ms. Van Winkle, could you get us statistics on how many complaints you might receive on cell phone insurance issues? Could you dive into that and also email it to the staff?
Yes, I can do that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, that would be great. Okay,
Good. Well, we appreciate you bringing this forward. Thanks. I do anticipate we'll move it. I would like to wait until next time around so that I get some clarification on this, but it seems like it would be just fine.
Yep. Awesome. Thank you.
Anybody else to testify on 4014? Okay. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4014. I don't need to roll that over, do I?
We can repost an agenda.
What? Yeah, what? Okay. And then I will open a public hearing on House Bill 4051.
Are you going to do this today?
Yes. I think
okay.
That's what I heard from one of the advocates, is that they've just decided to go forward and do it.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, House Bill 4051 came to you from the House Business and Labor. It passed out with 11-0 vote and went through the floor, 56 yeses, 1 nay. There's no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, and this measure has to deal with electronic posting of casualty and property insurance policies.
Dave Barrows and Sean Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Barrows. I'm here today representing Progressive Insurance. As you look at the bill, Mr. Chairman, it amends one section of the code. Subsection 3 is really the bill, and the changes in subsections 1 and 2 are simply style and form changes the Legislative Council made to existing law, and there's no change in the law. They just use this as a vehicle to do the two paragraphs that they wanted to make fit with style and form today. This bill would simply modify the law dealing with property and casualty insurance policies to permit the electronic posting, as your administrator said, of the general provisions of an insurance policy that you purchase. First, the company has to decide to offer this particular proposal that's found in subsection 3. Second, if they decide to do that, and some of them will, some of them won't, the company will then do what it always does, and it has always done, and that is they will send to the purchaser the declaration page that lays out all the specifics of that individual's policy. They would then post the general provisions on a website. Nothing about the individual would be contained in that posting. When the declaration page is mailed to the policyholder, either on that sheet or attached to it will be two options that the policyholder would have. One, they could go to the website and read all of the material that is in the provision, the general provisions, what I call the lawyer talk. Or, secondly, it will say there's an 800 number. If you would like to receive a full copy of your policy, call this 800 number, and we will be delighted to mail it to you. The bill also provides that the company, when the policy terminates or the relationship between the policyholder and the company terminates, the policy must be archived by the company for 10 years. And I will indicate to you, Mr. Chairman, I have not had any conversations with the insurance division this session, but this bill was heard at the very end of the last session in House Rules, and the Insurance Commission, which is exactly the same bill except that the 10 years was 6 years in the one last time, the Insurance Division said it was fine with them. They could administer it, made sense, they had no problems with it. As your administrator said, the bill passed with one no vote in the on the floor. It was unanimous in the committee. There was no adverse testimony. And frankly, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude by saying this is an attempt by Progressive Insurance, the chief executive officer, to cut down the amount of paper that is used to send repetitive lawyer speak language to consumers, most of which consumers never bother to look at. So that's the whole genesis of the bill, and Mr. Miller can tell you a little about what has occurred in other states.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller here today on behalf of the Property Casualty Insurers Association. As Dave indicated, you know, this is a fairly new concept, and just recently about 13 states have enacted laws to allow this particular practice. And, you know, the documents that we're talking about in the insurance policy, again, Dave, you know, talked about the declarations page, which, again, is all your personalized information regarding your specific policy. That's still going to continue to be sent to you as Dave indicated. The more generic forms, which are the same parts of the policy that are filed with the insurance division, it's the same language that an insurer would file. That's the portion of, again, the generic part of the insurance policy is would be then provided for a website for that consumer to visit, or again have sent, as Dave indicates. So again, it's just distinguishing between that personalized portion of your policy that you're still going to get that information, and then whether you could take that thick part of that document that's normally sent in your insurance policies, and again choose to look at that online. That's the bill. We would ask for your support, and happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? All right. I think on this one, I'd like to mull it over for a couple of days since it's a new topic to us. So I will, seeing nobody else is ready to testify, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4051. And
thank you.
Anything else for the good of the order? All right. And we have Senator Monty Sanderson carrying 4038A. And we are adjourned.
Thank you.